This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation. Mystery Hour with James O'Brien.
4 minutes after 12 is the time. Goodness me, it's always a blessed relief to reach this part of the week, isn't it? But some weeks even more, I think we can all agree, than others. So here it is, your weekly opportunity to achieve the sort of satisfaction not ordinarily available anywhere else on your radio dial. It's very good fun as well. I can pretty much guarantee you a giggle. I used to guarantee a laugh out loud moment, but of course you can't prove to me that you haven't laughed out loud, and I got tired of handing back refunds to people who I'm sure were lying about not having laughed out loud, but were insisting that they had only laughed inwardly, or perhaps giggled, but not lolled, as the kids say. And by kids, I think I mean anyone over 30, really, don't I, these days. How does it work? You ring in with a question, someone else rings in with an answer. That's pretty much it. But you're not allowed to look up the answers. We rely upon accrued knowledge. It's a celebration of education, of knowledge, of retention of knowledge, which is kind of unfashionable when you think about it. Because we have the world at our fingertips, you can find out stuff that you would once have had to visit a library and consult several books before finding now by simply throwing a few words into a search engine. And it's such a diverting hour that it has spawned its own board game. The Mystery Hour board game, we called it. We had a lot of meetings about that. What are we going to call it? I don't know. What should we call it? What are we going to call it, lads? Oh, God. And then one genius came up, the Mystery Hour board game. James O'Brien's Mystery Hour board game. I resisted that for reasons of modesty. But they insisted, the manufacturers at Big Sky Games insisted that not only is it called James O'Brien's Mystery Hour board game, but also they made me put a photograph of myself on the box. So if you're passing through, it is, as Keith said in my ears, a very old photograph. It is a very old photograph. I cannot tell a lie. But, you know, didn't want to rather pay for another photo shoot or something like that. There's a recession on the horizon. So you can find out more about the Mystery Hour board game at mystery. Is it mysteryhour.co.uk? You can win one by being the best contributor to this hour of radio. You can also buy it in John Lewis and some other shops as well. But if you are my favourite contributor of the hour, you will win a Mystery Hour board game. And the terms and conditions for that exciting offer can be found, as so much other riches can, at lbc.co.uk. 7 minutes after 12 is the time. I think we're good. Should we just crack on? I haven't forgotten anything. No repetitive way. Don't look anything up, all right? That's it. Michael is in Barnard Castle. How's your eyesight?
Pleasure to speak to you, James.
Thank you, mate.
I lost my dad to COVID, and your voice was just so reassuring and comforting to listen to. So thank you.
Thank you, Michael.
Question, yeah, who's the shortest serving Chancellor of the Exchequer?
Oh, no. I looked this up yesterday.
Well, I was going to look it up due to current sort of...
Of course, because I was thinking...
I thought, no.
It must be Nadeem Zahawi, but it wasn't. Because I can't remember why I looked it up, but I looked it up. I think it was someone who passed away, actually.
The answer today could be different tomorrow, but...
It could indeed, actually. That's a very good point, actually. I can't remember. Is it a McWhirter? I'm not going to get a round of applause for something McSomething, Michael, but I'm pretty sure it was someone McSomeone.
There's a Mac in there.
I'll find out for you, mate. Thank you for the kind words. Did you say you'd lost your dad?
Right. Well, he had Alzheimer's, but he then went in, got COVID. I'm sorry to hear that.
But
your voice was just very comforting when I had to go down and see him and stay.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. It's a lovely thing to say, and I'm so sorry for your loss. There will come a time.
No,
you won't get there yet, because it's all so fresh, but there'll come a time when the fact that he knew how much you loved him will be a great comfort to you. It really will. I promise you, mate. Take it easy. God bless.
And you take care.
Cheers, Michael. 8 minutes after 12 is the time. Joe is in Southend. Joe, question or answer?
Oh, it's a question, James, please.
Carry on, Joe.
How do knives work?
Yeah, it's a good one, isn't it?
I was chopping up a mushroom.
Oh, yeah. Is that a figure of speech?
No.
And, I used to chop up a few mushrooms back. Oh, no, that sounds completely inappropriate. Carry on.
So, no, just, you know, for a spaghetti bolognese.
Of course.
And
yes.
I was like, why does this work? Or to put it another way, why does a blunt knife not work? Or why does my finger not work? Or why does...
It's going to be molecular, is it, do you think?
It's going to be something like that, but then there's 100 questions attached to it. What makes something... What just how does it work?
No, I mean, I get it. I do. Yeah, I like it a lot. And I mean, it's up there, isn't it?
Thank you. I'm sorry to be... It's so simple, but it's...
It's just... a lovely... Well, the best questions offer... Well, I never get predictions right. If I call a question brilliant, it turns out to be rubbish. And I call a question rubbish, it turns out to be brilliant. So I'm trying not to do that anymore. But I mean, it is a good question. It is a... Because I don't know the answer. That's the best definition of a good question.
But you can tie it to sort of swords and scissors and whatever you like, but... What makes them work and what makes them not work on certain things?
Well, that's it. That's going to be contained within the answer to how do they work, isn't it?
Thank you so much.
No, thank you so much. And take care. How do knives work? 0345 60 60 973 is the number that you need. We should probably get the shortest serving chancellor out of the way quite quickly, because loads and loads of people are going to... Well, maybe they're not, but they may know the answer to that. Sam's in Amersham. Sam, question or answer?
Hi, James. Nice to speak to you again.
Hello,
I've got a question.
Carry on.
It's actually my mum's question. We were on holiday last week. I took her to Salzburg.
Oh, what was that like?
Her 80th birthday. It was lovely.
Was it?
Thank you.
Fantastic.
And, it's a city of music. Mozart's birthplace. And as we were wandering around his actual birthplace, she came up with this question. I thought, golly, I don't know the answer to that. Maybe James will know.
Mm-hmm.
So she said, well, can you get him to answer it on Mystery Hour?
Fantastic.
So the question is, musical annotation, was that invented by one person or was it just something that evolved?
Oh.
Do you have any ideas?
Yeah, you mean like the paper written
music,
down with
music,
the with the clef. What are they called? Staves and...
Exactly.
Minims
and
crotchets.
Who decided that there should be
quavers,
a
treble clef
and all of those things?
I'm going on. Did someone originally invent it? Did it ever? When did it first appear? Is what we want, isn't it?
Something along those lines.
I like it.
Would be
I shall
really
do my best to find out. Would you recommend a trip to Salzburg?
Absolutely beautiful, and the cakes are beyond compare.
I went to Vienna a few years ago, and it is a different world of. You think the French or the Japanese are the kings of patisserie, but the Austrians
every time.
Oh, holy moly! Sam, you're on. I give my love to your mum. I shall do my best to get her the answer that she craves. Quite a lot of people unhappy with Joe for putting mushrooms in a spaghetti bolognese. Listen. But bolognese isn't even a dish that most Italians recognise. It's a complete... It's a bit like chop suey or something like that. It's a dish that's essentially invented for tourists. So he can put, if he wants to put mushrooms in it, he can. A ragu? You have a ragu? Then maybe you can put mushrooms in it? I'm not sure, but don't get all on your high horse with me about Joe's decision to put a few mushrooms in it. There's a flipping recession around the corner. You know, you bulk up your bolognese with a few mushrooms, and fair play to you, I say. Alex is in Wrexham. Alex, question or answer?
James.
Carry on.
Thank you. I've been listening to your programme now for a few weeks,
and
a couple of questions occurred to me listening to your programme, which is excellent, by the way.
Thank you very much.
What's the difference between truth, fact and knowledge? Are they all the same? Are
no.
they intertwined? And what? Let's look at truth. What do we mean by truth?
This is quite a big question. I mean, in many ways, it's a whole module in a philosophy bachelor's degree. It's epidemiology, isn't it, or something?
Yeah, well, I've looked into it, but every time...
Well, hang on, let's pick
it. I've had debates at work, and everybody's got their own idea about it.
Yeah, but knowledge is a collection of facts. So there's a difference there. Knowledge is the bank, and fact is the money, right?
OK.
So we can do that. Truth and fact, I think, are synonyms. I think an objective truth is a fact. So truth and fact are the same, and the place where they reside is called knowledge.
Is it your truth or is it my truth?
No, if it's an objective truth, it's a fact.
So if it's objective,
yeah.
It's
a fact. I don't know, 2 + 2 = 4, or even if you stick your hand in a pan full of boiling water, it will get burnt. These are truths and facts.
Okay, well, what about personal experience then? Factually, I might experience something, and this way I can get into the political side of it and say factually that's what I've experienced in the past, therefore it will happen time until I
begin. No, well, this is David Hume, you see. This is blending correlation and causation. This is extrapolating from the fact that every crow you've ever seen is black means that the next crow you will see is black. But that's neither truth nor fact, actually, because it is epistemologically unprovable.
Okay, so what about statistics then? So
you can talk about a huge statistic likelihood that the next crow you will see will be black, but you can't call it a fact or a truth.
So it's a truth as long as every time you've experienced that thing...
No, it's a truth to say every crow I've ever seen is black. That's a truth, that's a fact. But you can't say the next crow I see will be black, because you can't know that.
You've got the subjective truth.
Well, there's not really any such thing.
You've got an absolute truth, haven't you?
No, absolute and objective are the same. There's not really any such thing as a subjective truth. The subjective truth would be a belief, really.
Correct, yeah, I totally agree. Absolutely.
And if you prove that it's true, it ceases to be subjective and it becomes objective. So the moment a subjective truth is proved to be true, it becomes an objective truth and therefore a fact, and therefore it will make up part of your knowledge.
Where does that leave religion?
That's all belief.
So it's not a truth?
No. Well, it's a subjective truth for the people that believe. But if God turns up, then it becomes an objective truth.
Totally get that one. So let's go through it again. So a truth is absolutely objective.
If it's objective, it's a fact. If it's subjective, it's a belief.
Okay.
And if it's a fact, i.e. an objective truth, then it makes up part of your knowledge. Because knowledge is different from fact in the way that a bank is different from a pound.
Okay, I think I get you.
Yeah.
I think so, anyway. I need to absorb that.
Of course. By a process of intellectual osmosis.
Well, try my hardest, James. But thank you very much.
No, thank you. I enjoyed that. It reminded me of being at college, and I think I earned at least one of these. 12:16 is the time. Apart from the first time the hairdresser asked me whether I wanted to have my ear hair trimmed, being told that it was time to make a will brings home most profoundly the passage of time and, of course, the importance of thinking carefully about what you do and who you leave money to. It's not just nearest and dearest. It can also be a legacy that makes enormous differences to the lives of people you may never meet. Cancer Research UK, for example, gets about a third of its funding from gifts in wills, and they are putting it to incredible use. Over the past 40 years, the prospect of surviving cancer has doubled in the UK. Understanding has grown, technologies have advanced, and there are hundreds of innovative research projects and trials underway as we speak. Many, many more prime for funding. To learn more about pledging a gift in your will to Cancer Research UK, visit cruk.org/legacy.
Mystery Hour on LBC with James O'Brien.
19 minutes after 12 is the time. The shortest serving Chancellor. How do knives work? What is the origin of musical annotation? Was it invented by one person? And we did the truth, facts and knowledge. Lots more knowledge to come involving lots of facts and objective truths. But no subjective truths allowed, because that's how you prove you can go definitive. That's why I asked. There you go. I should have thrown that into the last one, shouldn't I? Was it Alex? I think it was. The idea that you can, when I say, you give me an answer, and at that moment it's a truth, possibly a subjective truth, I say, what are your qualifications? And then we establish in a way whether or not it becomes an objective truth, at which point it becomes part of our shared knowledge. Wow. Nick's in Croydon. Nick, question or answer?
Answer.
Carry on.
Why do knives work?
Yes. How do knives work?
How?
Crucial difference.
Okay,
yes.
Well, how is GCSE physics, pressure equals force over area.
Right.
So for a given force, say 10 newtons,
yeah,
the smaller the area, the greater the pressure you're bringing to bear.
Yeah.
So it's why needles go through skin rather than a piece of dowel. And it's why cheese wire cuts through cheese, and it's why knives cut through anything, because they have a very, very small surface area in contact with the mushroom or the piece of meat or whatever it is.
Pressure equals force over area, and
over
it's the area,
area
of what we'll call the blade.
The area of the area of contact between the blade and the mushroom.
Ah, so knife plus mushroom area.
Yeah, so it's the sharper the blade, the greater the pressure, and it's why sharp knives are safer than blunt knives.
Because you don't push down as hard with them as you would...
Yeah, exactly. And therefore,
which is why you can do lots of people do a mischief trying to open oysters with a relatively blunt instrument, because they're using so much pressure that when it skips off the oyster and hits the skin, you're in all sorts of trouble.
Yeah, there's also, you have to find exactly the right point to try and force the blade in, otherwise you're fighting a losing battle.
That's very true. Well, that is a brilliant answer to a brilliant question, actually. Question or answer? I mean, qualifications? Sorry.
Retired teacher taking 4 children through GCSE physics.
That's nice. I like that.
Well, yeah, I'm not a science teacher by trade, but I've had to take my kids through.
You did your own? Did you do physics with your own kids?
Yeah.
What did you teach?
English.
There's quite a difference.
There is, but I did A-level physics and chemistry and biology.
Did you really? What made you change to English later?
The realisation I was useless at maths and could never be a doctor.
Okay, but so it was medical school on the horizon, slowly slipping out of sight, but then you ended up an English teacher.
Yeah.
Do you know exactly who else was like that? Michael Rosen.
Really?
You know the poet Michael Rosen? He was at medical school.
I love Michael Rosen.
I love Michael Rosen as well.
And I love what he's had to say over the years to education secretaries.
I thought you might.
Yeah.
He's very much a force for good. You should listen to the Full Disclosure interview I did with him. He gives me chapter and verse on how he sort of almost accidentally ended up training to be a doctor.
Yeah, well, I'm living vicariously now. I've got one who's at university studying to be a dentist, okay, and the other who's just started studying psychology.
Fantastic. So that's your teeth and your mind. That's your teeth and your mind looked after. What about the rest of you?
Falling apart.
Nick, lovely stuff. Did he get a round of applause? Did we give him one? A round of applause for Nick, please, Keith. Thank you very much. 23 minutes after 12 is the time. Sana is in Uxbridge. Sana, question or answer?
It's a question.
Carry on.
So I was watching Netflix, and you know how they have the parental guidance of the PG-12, PG-15 stuff written on the top?
Yes.
And that made me wonder, why don't novels and books have the same, for the same reason?
It's a very good question, actually. I don't know that. Well, I mean, there is one rather obvious answer to this.
I wonder what that is.
It's because you can judge a book by its cover. I got that off Keith.
Not always, James.
No, obviously not. Obviously not. I mean, to be honest with you, there are now attempts in academic institutions, universities and schools to do a form of warning or age rating. They call it a trigger warning, and it will tell people before they read something that it might contain something that will disturb them or bring back unpleasant memories or trigger flashbacks or post-traumatic stress disorder. And very stupid right-wing people who use the word woke as an insult pretend or genuinely do get very, very angry about the idea of trigger warnings on books. But you remind me that theoretically they should be angry about age ratings on films, shouldn't they? The idea that we should be careful with what we expose ourselves to. But I mean, Julie points out that libraries used to have children's sections. I mean, you have distinctions, don't you? You have children's books. Young adult fiction is a very big genre now, and then adult fiction. But you never, so you have a rough idea. If you're in the adult section, it's going to be an adult book. But there's no book you can't read at a certain age.
Yeah, exactly. So, for instance, when I was 14, 15, I think I was reading The Kite Runner. And, I mean, looking back, I think it was had adult themes, like, yes. It would have certain, yeah, so, and that just made me wonder, I mean, it would make parents' jobs easier as well, and just,
maybe.
For the same reason as you have
as the films. I wonder what the psychology is of reading a written word rather than seeing actual images in front of you. But they put stuff on music, don't they? They put age warnings on lyrics sometimes, like swear words, but you never get it on a book. I don't know why. I tell you what I do know. Isn't The Kite Runner one of the most beautiful books you've ever read?
Oh, it is. Oh, yeah, absolutely. One of the ones by Khaled Hosseini, but definitely The Kite Runner.
It haunts me. I still remember some of the scenes. The stuff in the football stadium.
See, that's what I mean. It does haunt you,
yes,
right?
Yes. It really does. It really does. Let's find out. I imagine the answer is that books have been around longer than the church would have probably done it once. The church used to, and they still burn books. But I imagine the answer will be that books have been around longer than the idea that we should be limiting access to them. But I don't know. I love that. We'll find out. Thank you, Sana.
Thanks, James.
Take care. 26 after 12 is the time. Why don't books have age ratings? Some of them can be very racy. In fact, she's reminded me once of, you know, those little weird moments in your childhood that you don't quite understand until years later? So as a kid, right, I used to read everything. I would inhale books. I'm still pretty good, but, you know, there's more demands on your attention these days. And I'd read every book in the house. I'd read every book in the library at school. I'd read books. And I'd be about 10. No, probably about 8 or 9. Because it was the kids' library. It wasn't that big. And I'm in Owen Owen, in the department store in Kidderminster, and I say to Mum and Dad, like I'd always say, can I buy a book? Can I have a book? And they had a book section. And I loved books so much that I just bought the biggest ones at this stage. And they had those sort of three-in-one books. Do you remember those hardback novels? Quite cheap, but you'd have three novels in, like in a bargain section of a book section. And so I just bought the one that had the most pages. I thought, there's three books here. That's great. And I took it to the till, and Mum and Dad paid for it. It was hardback, so it didn't have any blurb on either side. And then we bumped into my old English teacher from when I was about 6. And obviously Mum goes, oh, James has just bought a book. And my old English teacher, she said, oh, can I have a look at it? And she had a look at it. And I realised now, looking back, something happened. She sort of blanched a bit and went, wow, that's great. You're really reading above your age now, aren't you? And gave me the book back. And it was actually quite a saucy book. One of the three novels was by a bloke called James Hadley Chase, which was not appropriate for a 10-year-old boy, I don't think. And obviously, my English teacher, who I'd had when I was 6, clearly knew this. And I think the actual précis of the book in the front said something about, like, she was the blueprint of her. And then the word for a female dog or something like that. God, how did I remember that after all these years? So maybe that should have had a little badge on the front of it, and then Mum wouldn't have bought it for me in Owen Owen in about 1981. There you go. Anecdote corner. Graham's in Southgate. Graham, question or answer?
The question would have been, when are you going to be Prime Minister?
Oh, you're very kind.
But the real question is, I've got a jigsaw, 1,000 pieces, from your River Dee in the aqueduct in, I can't even pronounce it,
don't worry.
Welsh.
Lovely.
I've done about 55-60% of it.
Right.
I'm just stuck. I just can't.
Well, it is a first. So you want advice on how to proceed with your jigsaw?
Yeah, I've put it in the box. I've got another one with hot balloons.
So you haven't given up on it?
No, I'm going to put it back, but...
All right, I'll find. I mean, I don't know. I mean, is there such a thing as advice for doing jigsaws? I mean, you've done 50 or 60% of it. I'd have been asking you for advice.
No,
we'll find out for you. I mean, what? So 50 or 60% of it is done, and Graham just can't get arrested. He can't cop a break. What should he do next? That's the question.
Perfect.
Right, you're on. Okay, thank you. And thank you for the kind words. If they were kind, I don't know. I don't know if that's something you might wish on your worst enemy, given how the current Prime Minister is performing. I think Liz Truss made a wish to be Prime Minister on the monkey's paw. It's coming out to 12:30. You're listening to James O'Brien on LBC. I like this. I should have read this out a little sooner. Fact, a tomato is a fruit. Knowledge, knowing that a tomato is a fruit. Wisdom, not putting a tomato in a fruit salad. And quite a nice update from that truth, fact, knowledge question that Alex asked earlier. It is 12:30, and Tim Humphrey is here now with your headlines.
Disney Plus invites you to witness Wedding Season, a brand new original series.
You crash Katie McConnell's wedding. A few hours later, 8 guests were poisoned.
Like food poisoning?
Like dead poisoning.
Celebrate the perfect marriage of dark comedy and thrilling action.
I can't go on the run.
Take the leap.
Oh my God, okay, he's trying to kill us.
Wedding Season, an original series. Now streaming exclusively on Disney Plus. 18 plus subscription required. T's and C's apply.
Mystery Hour with James O'Brien. This is LBC.
33 minutes after 12 is the time. Mystery Hour continues. Natalie's in Taunton. Natalie, question or answer?
Answer.
Carry on.
Okay, so notation.
Yes.
Basically, in about the 8th century, something like that, there was a monk in Italy who came up with this idea because...
Whoa. We're going to have to do a lot. But basically, there was a monk in Italy who came up with this idea in the 18th century. Have you ever listened to Mystery Hour before?
No. Not the 18th century. The 8th century.
Well, that's even worse.
Okay, so...
What was his name?
I've no idea. I can't remember.
Well, you're not going to get a round of applause. However, whatever happens next.
Okay. Well, I apologise for that.
That's all right.
You know,
you crack
I'll carry on anyway.
Yeah, I know. Why not? Eh?
The because in Middle Ages, Dark Ages, they would sing most of the, well, all of the Bible, basically, and all of the texts in services, and it's bloody hard to remember, very hard to remember it. So he kind of thought there must be a better way. So he came up with this plan of the one single line, which was originally red, apparently.
Right.
And so with one line, you can have three different pitched notes. You can have a note, a blob above it, a blob, a line going through it, and one below it.
Exactly. La, la, la.
Yeah, exactly. So that was the beginning, and then gradually more lines were added.
For more notes.
Until eventually there were 11.
Right.
And that was known, as the Great Stave. Now, another good quiz question is, where does middle C come from?
No, hang on. What is this? Hang on a minute. Calm down. Yeah? You can't just ring in, pose questions, answer them. So we don't know where it started, but we think it was an unidentified monk.
Well, the name was mentioned. I've just forgotten his name.
Yeah, well, I'm going to need the name because the question was literally who invented it? Who invented musical annotation? That's what Sam's mum wants to know.
Okay. Ask Howard Goodall because that's where I got my information from.
I will. I'd say he might even be in the building at the moment, Natalie.
Well, there you go.
Howard, if you're in the building, mate, come down, wave through the window, we'll get you in.
He did a fantastic series of programmes about 20 years ago called The Big Bangs of Music.
On Classic? Was it on Classic?
It was what he considered to be the five most important, significant moments in the history of music.
Everything Howard Goodall has done is brilliant. Every single thing
absolutely,
he does is
absolutely.
Magic. Oh, that was Freddie Mercury.
Yeah. Yeah, and one of the episodes was about notation.
Okay.
And so he explained it all.
And that's what
that.
You remember, but you don't quite remember the name of the 8th century monk.
No, I don't remember the name of the monk.
Well, I'm going to give you a round of applause. I shouldn't. It's my curse, is my kindness and generosity. I'm going to give you a round of applause.
But thank you very much.
No, you're very welcome. What are your qualifications, just listening to Howard Goodall?
Well, no, and as another retired teacher of music as the actual subject, watched that video so many times, but it's a very, and I use that information in my teaching. Can I tell you about the middle C, please?
No, I can't. I mean, why would you do that? I mean, I've just been really generous. I'm going to get so much jip for giving you a round of applause when you don't deserve it. And now you're trying to make me feel bad. I mean, that is really awful behaviour, actually, Natalie.
I'm
minded not to give you a round of applause at all now, because essentially you've done, it's like with my children, you give them something and they behave as if that's not enough. I'm going to give you a round of applause and you can wait until someone asks the middle C question. It's obviously got something to do with the move from 11 lines to back down to 5 or 6. But anyway, thank you. And it was on the telly, obviously. God, someone just came around the corner then. I thought it might be Howard Goodall, but it's not. It was obviously on the telly, that programme she was referring to, because she watched the video of it. So not on our sister station, our rather splendid sister station, Classic FM. 12:37 is the time. Mark is in Harold Hill. Mark, question or answer?
It's an answer.
Right.
Jimmy the O. There he is. James, it's about the jigsaw.
Go on, what?
Right. I mean, you've got to do the edge, right? So you get all the straight bits and you make your edge. There's your frame.
I'm presuming he's done that.
Yeah, well, let's say he's stuck then. I mean, you get
he
all
is
your colours.
He's stuck. It's what he rang in. What do you mean, let's say? Yeah.
Let's say he's got to a point where he's got sea or sky or grass.
Yeah.
Right?
It's a viaduct, so there's going to be sky, isn't there, if it's a picture of a viaduct.
So there's a big patch of sky,
you're left
with, say, 50 pieces.
Yeah, well, he's got more than that. He's only done 60, he's got about 300 or 400 pieces left. He's done 60% of a 1,000-piece jigsaw.
Well, then you just got to keep putting the pieces in.
It was Sting, not Freddie Mercury, wasn't it? Every little thing she does is magic.
Yeah, it was Sting, yeah.
Oh, dear, I'm missing all my marks at the moment.
So I was told not to say the B word that woman just said.
No, don't do that. Don't do that. No, don't do that.
But it's be-minded. Yeah? Be-minded.
Yeah.
So you've just got to be-minded.
Oh, you mean persistent. You've got to be stubborn. So you get all your sky bits.
You've got to keep putting every bit in. So you've got 49 pieces. You get one to fit. So 48, 47, 46, 45. In the end, the last one. Put it in. There's your sky. There's your picture.
All right. So he just needs to concentrate on the sky for a while, and then he'll. Why did you do that? And then you'll get a what's a mit jig. You'll get enough. I hope so. I'm taking that as the definitive answer. Sorry, because I don't want any other answers to that question. Sorry, Graham, and sorry, Mark. Well done. Yeah, round of applause for Mark. You can have that. I'm not even going to ask what his qualifications are. Gavin is in Jersey. Gavin, question or answer?
Good afternoon, James. I have a question, please.
Hello, Gavin. Thank you. What is it?
I'm currently in the process of arranging our wedding, and along with all the excitement, we have a question. Why is the first meal after you're married called a wedding breakfast, considering they don't serve cereal and it's an evening?
I know this.
Oh, go on.
No, it's I think it might even be in the board game, this one. I think it is. I think that married couples used to have to fast before they got married, like for religious reasons. I think you went with a, you know what I mean? Like you go in Lent, or if you're a Muslim, you don't eat during daylight during. I think it's Ramadan. So I'm pretty sure that
they'll be like the first meal together.
Yeah, but and also in my religion, you're supposed to not eat or drink anything before taking communion for an hour. So I imagine that the meal you have after the service is called a breakfast, whatever time of day it is.
Okay.
It's good that, right?
Yeah.
You don't sound very excited about that. Why is that?
yeah, it's just.
Are you having a church service?
No, not overly religious.
No, fair enough. So technically, you won't be having a breakfast. Actually, you'll be having a wedding feast or something, or a wedding lunch.
Yeah, I just all the brochures have it as the wedding breakfast.
Because literally in the olden days, you'd be in the church, you'd be coming out of the church, and you'd be having a bit of cake or a biscuit or something like that. You'd be breaking the fast with a lovely treat. You see, the breakfast, yeah. The wedding breakfast, is part of the wedding. Ceremonial process. When you're coming out of the church, you break your fast. That's it. That must be it. I know that's it. I can remember it. I'm pretty sure it's in the ball game. If it's not in the ball game, we've done it before. If we haven't done it before, I did it in my A-level religious studies.
Brilliant. Thanks very much.
When are you getting married?
Next June 2024.
Oh, blimey.
So giving ourselves a bit of time. Yeah, you certainly are.
Well, good luck with it. It's a magical day. I hope it's wonderful. I'm sure we'll speak before. Round of applause for me.
Thank you.
No, thank you. I tell you, it would be a nice wedding present for Gavin, wouldn't it? Be a copy of the Mystery Hour board game there for him and his new wife to perhaps play on their honeymoon. Patrick's in Dartmoor. Patrick, question or answer?
It's a question.
Carry on, Patrick.
James.
Patrick.
I'm at a small gathering of farmers who are ploughing fields with horsepower.
Yes. Well, right now?
Yes.
Oh.
They're just coming to the end of a morning's ploughing.
Okay.
Now, the question I posed to one of the farmers was, is that Shire horse pulling the plough or pushing the plough and it has caused mayhem? Because the dispute is whether the horse is pulling the plough or pushing the plough. I have my idea and they have theirs. We can't seem to agree.
Are all the farmers in agreement, and you are the grit in the oyster?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a great one for swimming against the tide, Patrick.
Yeah.
But I mean, I'm going to go out on a limb here and say you think that the horse is pushing the plough.
Yes.
Yes. Why do you think that?
To make a horse work with a plough or a cart, one must apply a yoke around the horse's neck.
Oh, here it comes.
And the yoke is attached to the cart.
Correct.
Now, the horse is pushing into the yoke.
Correct.
Which, in turn, pushes the cart from the rear in that direction.
Not from the rear, though.
The cart is following the horse because the horse is pushing into the yoke.
Yeah, but the
However,
the yoke is the means by which the horse pulls the plough.
It pushes.
No, the horse pushes the yoke, but that is why the horse is pulling the plough. So the yoke is like a tool. It's the weapon.
A means to an end.
Yes. So the horse is pushing the yoke, but pulling the plough. Yeah. You're both right, except you. Well, no, they're right. You're wrong. Also, there's no way I'm going to fall out. I'm not Alan Partridge. I'm not going to fall out with every farmer in Devon. That would be a stupid thing to do. We all know what happened when he did that. So the horse is pushing the yoke. What?
It caused mayhem.
I bet it. I can see why. What is the name of the event? Does it have a name? Is it a Dartmoor?
No, it's just a small group of people with. Suffolk Plows. Punch and Yes. Just rip the field to pieces.
So apparently Victorian Farm says it pushes, but I don't know what that's based on. It's pushing the yoke, but it's pulling the cart. The yoke is, no, I mean, it's got to be, they're right, you're wrong, Patrick. And I'm fairly confident of this, all right?
Okay, well, look, thank you very much.
No, thank you very much.
With you.
No, I know you are. I can tell you. I'll take another round of applause, though, because I'm feeling greedy today. Right. I think we've got the Yorkshire Farmer on Full Disclosure this week, or next week, actually. That's a fascinating, it's a brilliant programme. I'll ask her. She might have a view on it. Thank you, Patrick. All human life is it, and indeed equine life as well.
You spend, and then you spend some more. But what if using a new payment method could put a surprise in your wallet? Earn a £10 reward when you sign up for PayPal and spend, send, or donate £10 or more the first time. Now that's money well spent. Learn more at paypal.co.uk. PayPal Europe SARL at sea SCA offer ends 31st of October 2022. Limited to the first 170,000 new PayPal customers. T's and C's apply.
Mystery Hour with James O'Brien. This is LBC.
It is 12:49. You're listening to James O'Brien on LBC. David's in Barnet. David, question or answer?
It's a question, please, James.
Carry on, mate.
Okay, so electronic readers like Kindles, yeah. How do books get on there? I can understand if something's prepared digitally, if someone's written a book on a computer.
Yeah.
But if it's a classic, would it have to be rewritten? Is there some way of photographing it with text recognition? How do we get it onto our Kindle or other e-reader?
So someone's typed it in.
So they're going to have to retype all the classics. There are millions of books on these things. Millions.
Yeah.
So that's how they do it. That someone's going to sit there.
Well,
and
I thought it was obvious, but the producer's shaking her head at me with quite a gnomic look on her face.
I can't imagine that there are people typing millions and millions of books. And what about the mistakes they may make?
I don't understand your confusion.
Well, okay, if it's that simple, then maybe someone can confirm that for us.
Yeah, you're right.
It seems like an extraordinary amount of people would be involved in rewriting all of these manuscripts.
Oh, see, I think I'm beginning to understand what you mean. You mean there's simply so many of them?
Yeah, there are millions of books.
There are indeed. And they're all available electronically these days?
All available, yeah. So how did they get onto our screens?
So maybe but surely they'd have to be, in order to be printed on paper, they'd have to be on a computer database somewhere these days.
I've no idea. I mean,
you might as well have said, how do they get the words into books?
Well, we know how they did that originally.
But how do they do it now?
By typesetting. Well, now, of course, it'd be electronic, but originally it was typesetting.
So everything that's available on paper now will have been electronically typeset. And that's what they would...
Not necessarily.
Why not?
No, because things that are originally typeset would remain in typeset.
Well, what sort of book are you thinking about here? A book that hasn't been reprinted in about 200 years?
Well, anything. I mean, look, it's... it would be great if it were that easy.
All right, or some form of photograph, some form of scanning, and then they just translate it directly into electronic.
Yes, that's what I want to know. Is it scanned or is it rewritten by hand?
All right, you're on. Okay. The only bit I'm not getting is all of these books that you don't think that are available in paper, but you don't think anyone's ever... You think they're still using the sort of technology that they would have used in the 18th century or the 19th century to produce Charles Dickens novels rather than the same technology that they use to produce Richard Osman's novels?
Well, yeah, there is a discrepancy there somewhere because obviously they were originally mechanically set and printed. You know how printing works. You were in the game.
If only we had a best-selling author here who could talk us through. Oh, hang on a minute.
I wonder.
I wrote my book on a computer... And I sent it to the publisher, and then it gets put into the Kindle, and it gets put onto paper as well. So
because it was digitally originated in the first place. That's why it was easy. But Dickens wasn't you know, put on a computer.
No, but I bet you someone has put Dickens on a computer subsequently.
Well, that's what I'd like someone to confirm.
Okay, I shall find out for you. I shall find out. Well, I hope I will. I've spent so long blathering on and trying to insert a few plugs for my books, How to Be Right in a World Gone Wrong and How Not to Be Wrong, The Art of Changing Your Mind. I might have run out of time in order to provide you with an answer, David.
Just the point of order then, James.
What's that then?
If the question can't be answered, can I phone back another time and re-ask it?
Of course you can. Of course you can.
Right, brilliant.
No, there's no guarantee you'll get through, but I mean, you are perfectly entitled to do that, especially if it's a question that clearly has an answer, like this one does. 12:52 is the time. Thank you, David. Anna's in Hackney. Anna, question or answer?
It's a bit more of a refined answer to the musical notation.
Good. Carry on.
Well, so the Mesopotamians might have been the ones to have devised what we know now as the notation for music. And that is through archaeology digs that have happened in modern-day Syria and Iraq, where tablets have been found with the notes etched into clay. And it all comes down to the basis of... And it all comes down to the basis of basically humans' need to express text into... articulate sort of text into sound or direction. Mm. And so there was actually recently some recordists and musicians played these older pieces and were able to play them because they are very, very similar to what the caller was saying, the period of time, the 8th century. It was actually Guido of Arezzo, I think that's how
Guido you pronounce D'Arezzo. His name. Guido D'Arezzo.
Yes, yes. And how that started was not a stave. It was when they were chanting religious scripts or speaking. They put little dashes. They
peccata
put little dashes.
Quitolis, peccata mundi.
Yeah. Something like that.
Yeah.
And then it embellished.
It's all coming back to me now.
And it just embellished over the years.
So that all the monks could sing in unison, they had to find some way of divvying up the notes and the music in a way.
Yeah, and then you had one rogue one that went a bit ad lib and did his oohs, and then they had to sort of like make staves for that, and so that's how it.
Qualifications?
I'm a composer.
Oh, fantastic. That'll do nicely. Yeah. So we don't know, but there is evidence of it in Mesopotamian archaeology.
Yeah, definitely. And it's the same as well. When you
is
look
it
at it,
really?
It's quite amazing.
Is it really?
Yeah.
And did Guido D'Arezzo just come up with it himself by coincidence? He came up with a relatively similar system, do we think?
Yeah, because it's quite basic. If you look
how
at
am I going to convey this idea? There's only really one way you could do it, isn't there? You'd have a scale with gradations of tone. And so they both came up with similar ideas, albeit a thousand years or so apart.
Yes, exactly.
Lovely
exactly
stuff.
That. Yes.
What sort of, if you don't mind me asking, Anna, what sort of stuff do you compose? What have you got anything that we can, any performances coming up or anything?
I haven't been well for a while.
Oh, I'm
so
sorry.
I haven't been able to compose, but I'm just in the middle of writing my first album.
Fantastic.
So but I do lots of classical and modern stuff and loads of stuff. But
fantastic.
Yeah, I love music.
Well, I can tell. It comes through. It shines through and it's earned you this, which is not very musical. But it's kind of timeless. Thank you, Anna. Zoe's in Fife. Zoe, question or answer?
Hello, James.
Hello,
it's
Zoe.
An answer.
What is it going to be? It's going to be either the shortest serving chancellor or the age ratings on books, is it? I think.
Age ratings on books.
Carry on then.
Yep. So,
the Kindle
you do get age ratings on books, particularly graphic novels.
Of course you do.
The reason that this sprung to me, I used to work for Waterstones for quite a few years. And my husband still does.
Okay.
Sorry if I mentioned the brand. Or the
no, we're big fans of Waterstones. They stock both of my books, How to Be Right in a World Gone Wrong and How Not to Be Wrong in The Art of Changing Your Mind.
Yeah,
actually, I had a special Waterstones edition of the second one because the first one was such a massive bestseller.
Always nice. Always nice.
Very
nice.
Very nice.
The other thing was I really remember, the first one I remember was Laura Palmer's Secret Diary.
The Twin Peaks spin-off.
Yeah.
Was that? Did that have
and
an age limit
back
on it?
When I was 14. And it was, I think it was at least a 15, if not higher. And I remember this because my mum would not let me read it. And it was definitely age rated.
It was naughty. But it didn't have to be age rated. I bet that was a marketing ploy.
Well, that's what I suspect for all of these things because,
And the graphic novels, I mean, that's imagery plus words, isn't it? Because if I was going to stick an age rating on anything from the canon, it would probably be Titus Andronicus, the last scenes of Titus Andronicus.
Yeah.
It's just still chilling me to
the core. If you think of something like The Boys, you know, it just, you could not.
No, you couldn't go there.
A child and all the conscience.
I like it, and I like your qualifications, and you've earned yourself a round of applause.
Thank you very much.
No, thank you very much. 12:57 is the time. John's in Brighton. John, question or answer?
Answer.
Carry on.
It's regarding how books get onto the Kindle, the classics.
Yes. Oh, yes.
It's called OCR, Optical Character Recognition.
Okay. So
you
they do scan it.
Scan or photograph the page, a computer recognises the shapes of the letter. That is then translated into text, and then it just needs to be proofread.
So David's having David's having a little wry chuckle at the moment about my attempts to dismiss his question or to undermine it. It was absolutely not the case that somebody somewhere has typed every book ever written into, but somebody somewhere has scanned every book ever written into a computer so that it could then appear on a Kindle. Qualifications?
I spent 30 years in the railway signalling industry, engineering, and we used OCR to translate the standards that were originally typed on a typewriter into the computer.
And you're confident that they do the same thing with books?
Absolutely.
That'll do nicely. Round of applause for John. I like that. Nice work. And finally, John in Birmingham. John, I know what this will be, and I've remembered the bloody name. Sorry. Okay. I've remembered the name now.
It's an answer, and it's a sort of serving answer.
I know, and I've remembered it.
I didn't know with your A-level in politics.
Well, actually, it was about, to be honest, I think that the fellow we're talking about passed away about 18 years before I sat my A-level in politics, but that's no excuse, is it?
It's Ian McLeod.
Ian McLeod.
He was appointed after the 1970 election by Edward Heath. He lasted a month and sadly died in 11 Downing Street of a heart attack. I think on 20th of July.
I mean, Chancellor McChancellor face is just not going to cut the mustard, is it? It's Ian McLeod is his name. I knew there was a muck in there.
There we go.
Qualifications?
He was replaced by Anthony Barber, who then brought in massive tax cuts, which led to a crash.
Replaced by Anthony Barber, who until very recently was regarded as having brought in the worst financial policy in the history of these islands.
History repeats itself. Qualifications, 20 years working in politics, 10 years elected politician and 7 years working for a Member of Parliament.
Oh, that'll do nicely, John. And a big round of applause for you. I've got to pick a winner, haven't I? I think Anna, do you think Anna the composer was just lovely and she's not been very well, so she'd probably be glad of a board game? Should we give it to Anna? Yeah, Anna the composer gets the board game this week. But there's a lot of contenders, and it was only because she came on quite late that she's in the forefront of my mind. Well, actually, Sheila Fogarty is now in the forefront of my mind.
Here I am. You're done.
I am done.
I really, because the clock's behind me,
I should, yeah, absolutely. I've already taken a minute and 17 seconds of your programme, actually.
You, what a cheek.